everyone. Welcome to the Law Hour. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. It's an educational service in the public interest. I'm your host, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5 over North America and worldwide on the Internet 7 days a week. For more information about the Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour brings you important information about law news and current events. So stay with us while we get ready for tonight's special report on troubled waters right after this message. You know, when you make $50,000 a year, you're paying $7,650 in Social Security taxes. Then you pay an additional 17% tax on that same $50,000, which is another $8,500. And when you do that, you've just paid an extra $1,300 by paying your tax on a tax. And that makes the real effective Social Security tax rate 17.8%. It's not the 15.3% that's advertised by the IRS and Social Security. Now, isn't that just real special? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967. Help take a bite out of crime. Why don't you call and ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it? That's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School, and it's entertaining, educational, informative, and best of all, free of charge. Tax and status is also available on compact disc for home education. If you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Hey, I'm looking at a magazine here called World Arc, published by Heifer International. It's a quarterly publication, and they've got a good article in here on water, troubled waters. I thought I'd share with you this water story. You know, we see it everywhere. It's the rain, the rivers, the lakes. In rich nations, we turn the tap and out it pours. Some of us spend thousands of dollars installing automatic systems in our lawns so that it will keep our grass green all summer long. It's in everything that we eat. It's used to make almost everything that we buy. And yet, we think about it hardly more than the air we breathe. It's water. It's the basis of life. It comprises more than 70% of the human body, and water, like so much of the planet, is taken for granted and is now become endangered. How can this be when the Earth's surface is covered with water? The oceans are vast, but salty. Less than 3% of the Earth's water is fresh water. Two-thirds of that 3% is locked up in glaciers and ice caps. So there's only a tiny share. Less than 0.01% of the planet's water is both fresh and renewed each year by the sun-powered hydrologic cycle. That finite supply has not increased over the millennia, but our demands upon it have, and in many places, water and water use now exceeds the sustainable supply, causing rivers to run dry and underground water tables to drop. The unchecked pollution makes the water supply less usable. Now, the United Nations has designated 2003 as the International Year of Fresh Water in an attempt to focus attention on what is clearly one of society's, indeed one of the world's biggest challenges. How to meet human needs for water for 6 billion people without destroying the ecosystems that support life itself. Now, water is not a commodity like copper or oil. It's a fundamental life support, such as rivers, lakes, wetlands, and other freshwater ecosystems are not just sources of water. They are habitats for a wide variety of plant and animal species. These ecosystems provide essential services for human societies, moderating floods and droughts, purifying water, and sustaining fisheries. Fresh water has no substitutes for most of its uses. It's essential for growing crops, for manufacturing, and for drinking, cooking, and other household functions. The world's water problems have surged during the last 10 years, and awareness of them has grown, but the problems are far outpacing the implementation of solutions. And it isn't just in our country, it's worldwide. Now, the world is entering on unprecedented periods of risk to food security. The environment, the world economy, and social and political stability as water grows scarcer in every part of the world. The wild card of global climate change exacerbates these dangers. Now, here are some of the concerns. First of all, population growth is fastest in some of the world's driest regions, such as the sub-Sahara portion of Africa, North Africa, the Middle East, and the areas of Western Asia and South Asia. Number two, the per capita water demands are rising, and particularly in developing countries where greater income results in greater consumption of household water itself and of material goods that require water for production. Number three, as supplies tighten, farmers in particular will feel the squeeze as water shifts out of agriculture to satisfying growing urban and industrial demands. Four, many poor farmers lack access to irrigation water, which is needed to raise their land productivity and incomes. The vast majority of the world's poorest and hungriest people live in rural areas of South Asia and sub-Saharan Africa, where they eke out a bare subsistence living on farms of less than 5 acres. Five, more than a billion people lack even the most rudimentary delivery systems for clean water. And the technologies exist to provide these services, but the financial and other communities and commitments do not, to do so, have lagged, and they do not have them. And this deficiency continues to be the leading cause of disease and death in the developing world. A lack of access to safe, clean drinking water alone results in the deaths of more than 3 million people a year, and most of those are children. More people have died from diarrhea in the past 10 years than have been lost in armed conflict since World War II. And number six, fresh water is being used up. The Aral Sea, for instance, was once the world's fourth largest lake. But increased irrigation for production of cotton and other crops in the Central Asian deserts resulted in such extensive withdrawals from the two rivers that flow into the Aral Sea that by 1990, those inflows had fallen to about 13% of their natural flow levels. The river deltas and the lake can no longer sustain their ecological functions. The Aral Sea has lost two-thirds of its volume. About 60,000 fishing-related jobs are now lost, and people living in these salty and toxic surroundings suffer from a variety of illnesses. Water tables are falling from the overpumping of groundwater in parts of China, India, Iran, Mexico, and the Middle East, North Africa, and the United States. Many major rivers, including the Colorado River, the Ganges, the Indus, the Murray, the Rio Grande, and the Yellow Rivers, now run dry during parts of the year. Competition for fresh water increasingly is leading to social instability. And in the last few years, farmers in China and Pakistan, lacking enough water to irrigate their crops, have engaged in violent protests. Encompassing all of these difficulties is the necessity of protecting the Earth's overloaded ecosystem. People have viewed water supplies as resources solely for narrow range of human purposes, not as part of a living system or a system that serves to protect all of life on the planet. It's a mindset that sees water as a simple commodity, one ruled by the laws of supply and demand. And in this equation, estimates of water use by people are compared with the amount of water available. Or, society sees water as something to be divided among agricultural, industrial, and household uses. This mindset has dominated freshwater management and distribution over the past 200 years. Unfortunately, it's a grossly incomplete view of the role of freshwater in sustaining life, including human life. Now, examined holistically, water is a life support or, in economics parlance, natural capital. A healthy freshwater ecosystem provides goods and services essential to life. Some examples. More than 99% of irrigation, industrial, and household water supplies worldwide comes from natural freshwater systems. Fish, waterfowl, mussels, and clams, among other species, are important food sources for people and wildlife. Now, wetlands filter and break down pollutants, protecting water quality. Healthy watersheds and floodplains absorb rainwater and river flows, reducing flood damage. Healthy watersheds, floodplains, and wetlands provide homes and breeding sites for fish, birds, and other wildlife. Healthy river floodplain systems constantly renew the fertility of surrounding soils. Rivers carry nutrient-rich sediment to deltas and estuaries, helping maintain their productivity. Freshwater flows maintain the salt levels of deltas and coastal marine environments, a key to their biological richness and productivity. Natural rivers and waterscapes are sources of inspiration and deep cultural and spiritual values. Their beauty enhances the quality of human life. Swimming, fishing, hunting, boating, wildlife viewing, and waterside hiking and picnicking give pleasure to millions of people around the world, and a great variety of species perform the work of nature on which life depends, and conserving genetic diversity provides options for the future. And these services, however, traditionally have not been valued monetarily. Decisions about building dams or draining watersheds and wetlands have not taken into account the damage that these activities do to the ecosystem as a whole, so the ecosystems have been declining in a cascading fashion around the world, not just in the United States, but everywhere worldwide. The harm takes many forms: poorer water quality, increased flood damage and disruption of food webs, the decline of fisheries, and the loss of jobs and livelihoods, among all of the other causal factors that are debilitating our planet. From the Colorado River Delta in northern Mexico to the rich Ganges River Delta in Bangladesh, for example, fisheries and livelihoods that depend upon them are now declining. The reason for the decline? It's the depletion of water flows by upstream dams and diversions. Worldwide, at least 20% of the 10,000 freshwater fish species are now endangered, threatened with extinction, or they're already extinct. In North America, where at least 123 species of freshwater fish, mollusks, crayfish, and amphibians have been extinguished since 1900, projected rates of near-term extinctions of freshwater animal species rival those for species in tropical rainforests. Now, much of this damage and loss is because of the extensive fragmentation of rivers by dams, dikes, and other diversions, which has destroyed a great deal of the important work that healthy river systems do. Now, the draining and the filling of wetlands for agricultural and urban expansion have also taken a heavy toll. Worldwide wetlands, which provide goods and services estimated to be worth as much as $20,000 per per hectare. That's 2.5 acres. That would be $50,000. Excuse me, $20,000 per hectare, which is 2.5 acres, or about $4,000 an acre. In some areas, now cover only half the area that they did a century ago. I guess I got that one mixed up too. That's $8,000 an acre. 8 and 8, 16, and half would be 20. So it would be $8,000 an acre. Now, just because our economic formulas don't count these losses doesn't mean that they aren't real. It simply means that society is unaware of how much human and social welfare is declining because of our approach to using and managing water. Here's a couple of important factors for us to keep in mind. It may well be true that two-thirds of the world is covered by water, but only 3% of it is usable. 3% is fresh. And of the 3% of the total world supply of water, 2% of it is locked up in the ice caps, which means that only 1% of all the water on planet Earth is usable by you and me. Water locked up in the ice cap on Greenland is totally useless to us. And water locked up in the oceans of the South Atlantic are totally unusable to us. What's usable to me is the spring down below my house. What's usable to me is the water that's being pumped out of the ground by way of my well. What's usable to me is the water that comes out of the springs that fill my ponds to water my cattle. What's usable to you is the water that comes out of the tap in your kitchen, or that you use to flush your toilet, or the water that's used to wash your car down at the local laundromat, or wash your clothes at the laundromat and your car at the car wash. That's usable water, and all of that water that we use for industrial, household, and agricultural purposes here in the United States, get this, 90% of all the water used in the United States is for agricultural purposes. Only 10% is used for industry and homes, and 7% of the water is used for industry, and 3% is used for homes. So if you stop and think of all the water used in America, only 3% of the water that we use in America goes into our homes. We're not the big water users. It's agriculture is the big water user in America. Industry isn't even a big water user at 7%. Well, now the question arises, what are we going to do about it? Well, the answer is it's the United Nations and the Congress and all of these social welfare institutions that are talking about, here's what we've got to do to solve this water problem. My question to you is, well, what are you going to do to solve your own water problem? Out in the West, they're suffering from a drought going into the sixth and seventh year, depending on the location that you're located, west of the 100th meridian. This drought out there cuts your water supplies even lower. That's a problem in the western United States that we haven't faced since the 1930s, when we had the Dust Bowl, which is also a great drought period. And these drought periods occur every now and again. Probably every 70 to 100 years we'll come through one of these drought periods, and the last one lasted 10 years. If this one's a 10-year drought, we got another 3 years to go, and it has a very high economic impact upon us. California, if it were a separate individual nation, would be the fifth largest economy in the world. Those 31 million people that live in California, of and by themselves, represent 20% of the world's industrial and agricultural production, 20% of the world's economy. It would be the fifth largest economy in the world. Now, the situation isn't hopeless. Solutions do exist to these problems posed by the depletion of freshwater supplies. First of all, it's important that people grow to understand the value the work the rivers, floodplains, wetlands, and other ecosystems do. Freshwater ecosystem services are worth hundreds of billions of dollars annually. They particularly benefit the poor, who often depend directly on nature services for their livelihoods. Some places are taking steps to preserve these services. Australia, South Africa, and parts of the United States are establishing flow requirements for rivers, and these policies build on a growing scientific consensus that restoring a river's natural pattern of flow variability, its natural highs and lows during the year and across years, is a key to restoring river health overall, as well as the habitat that myriad species depend on for survival. By the time the Colorado River reaches the Gulf of Mexico, or the Gulf of Lower California, I should say, it is down to a trickle. You know, the Colorado River, by the time it gets to Mexico, has been totally used up, sometimes two or three times. The water is used, it runs onto the land, it irrigates the land, it runs off the land back into the river and down the river, and where it's diverted again and it runs onto the land and off. Basically, it's used for irrigation. Now, if you take a look at your lawn and how much water you use around your house, I'll bet you that you use more water growing grass in your lawn than you use flushing your toilets and cooking, washing dishes and bathing. Human beings really don't need very much water. We use a lot of water, but it's basically for our plants that we use the water. All of that water that's being brought into Los Angeles through the aqueducts from the Colorado River is used for growing green grass in the Los Angeles basin, not for bathing, cooking, or washing dishes. Number two, archiving universal access to safe drinking water and sanitation would save millions of lives yearly and prevent debilitating illnesses. Such action would have huge economic benefits as well, simply by reducing the high costs resulting from the loss of life and the loss of productivity due to poor health. Now, the World Health Organization estimated in 2000 that an additional 816 million people acquired access to safe drinking water between 1990 and 2000. But the number of people unserved remains about the same. That's about 1.1 billion. That's about one-sixth of the world's population. Because the population grew by nearly as many people as gained access, the number of people lacking adequate sanitation rose slightly between 1990 and 2000 to 2.4 billion, about 40% of the world's population. So the number of people lacking adequate sanitation rose. There are 2.5 billion people. 40% of the world's population do not have adequate sanitation for their sewage. Now, the United Nations Millennium Development Goals include targets of reducing by half the proportion of people lacking access to safe water, at least by the year 2015 as their goal. Now, the 2002 World Summit on Sustainable Development held in Johannesburg, South Africa, added to this goal a commitment to halve the number of people lacking sanitation by 2015. Achieving these goals, though, will take a dedication of political leadership and funding that has been rare to date. South Africa, an exception, is on track to achieving universal access to safe drinking water by the end of this decade. Now, public sector support for supplying safe water and sanitation must be increased, and especially in rural areas, which are home to more than 80% of people who lack safe drinking water. Governments and communities should take primary responsibility for providing water services. Privatizing water services only works if strong regulations are in place to protect the poor and the supply itself. leakage from existing urban systems often exceeds 30%, so making existing systems efficient is critical to cutting water waste. And number three, provide access to irrigation water to reduce rural poverty. Access to a minimum amount of water for the production of crops is essential to helping millions escape poverty. About 2.8 billion people live on less than $2 a day, and 800 million of these face chronic hunger. Providing poor farmers with the means to irrigate their farms is one of the best ways to help them move out of poverty. Hey, here's a couple of figures for you. If you take a look at the number of trees that are growing around your area, or in your area, well, a mature oak tree, we have a lot of them here in our region, a mature oak tree gives off or evaporates into the atmosphere 1,800 gallons of water a year. Well, it's, you know, let's see how many that is or how many gallons that is during the productive cycle of the year. 1,800 gallons, if we divided that by 365, it averages about 5 gallons a day. So you got a big tree in your yard. Well, that big tree in your yard is giving off about 5 gallons of water a day into the atmosphere. Multiply that by millions of trees. And that's the hydrologic cycle. That water going up into the atmosphere condenses and then rains back down to earth. Soaks back into the ground, is picked up by the trees again, evaporated out into the atmosphere, which then continues the cycle. Now let's cut down your tree. I mean, after all, we don't need all the trees. Let's just cut your tree down. Well, that only amounts to 5 gallons a day. Let's cut down a second tree, say in your neighbor's yard. Well, that only cuts it down by 10 gallons a day. Now let's cut down 4,000 square miles of trees. Because that's the number of trees, that's the size of the area that we're cutting down in the rainforests down in the Amazon basin and out in Africa every year. 4,000 square miles. Or about double the size of Delaware, or 4 times the size of Rhode Island. Now, Rhode Island is a small piece of real estate. It's only 1,000 square miles. Take 4 Rhode Islands, or about 1/2 of Massachusetts, or about 2 times the size of Delaware, all small states to be sure, and then cut all of the trees down on that much real estate. What kind of an effect does that have on the ecology? Well, we can measure it. Here's what it is. In the Amazon basin in 1957, the average rainfall was 120 inches a year. Today it's 90 inches a year, so it's been cut by 25% over the last 45 years, 45 to 50 years. We've cut it by 25%. It still rains down there, 90 inches a year. It still rains a whole bunch. That's a rainforest. It's a tropical rainforest. Now let's go to the Sahara. 2,000 years ago, the Sahara was equivalent to, in size and in rainfall, to our Great Plains from Denver, Colorado, east to the Mississippi River, the Great and Central Plains. It produced grass for animals, and vast herds of animals roamed across the Sahara. They ate it. Then we went in there, that is the Romans primarily, they went in there and they started farming it. Using slash and burn techniques, which is what mankind has always used. Slash it, burn it, farm it until it wears out and then move on. Slash and burn. Until today, the Sahara covers more than 3 million square miles. That's an area larger than the United States of America. Has been converted to desert in 2,000 years. Now, in the southern part of that desert, called the Sahel, the people there, in places like the Sudan in the east, and then west over to Chad and So on those people in those countries where they have trees, cut those trees down so that their goats will have forage. It's what they feed their goats with, oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes. And every time they cut a tree down, they cut the rainfall by 5 gallons, 5 gallons a day. Every tree they cut cuts the rainfall 5 gallons a day. Now, 5 gallons a day doesn't seem like much until you get 1 million trees cut, and then it's 5 million gallons a day. And 5 million gallons a day is 35 million gallons a week. 35 million gallons a week, you know, is millions and millions of gallons a month and billions of gallons a year. And pretty soon, as you have less and less rain, you have less and less vegetation. And less vegetation means greater and greater sizes of our deserts. You know, we're locked into a cycle of destruction that in the final analysis, if we don't reverse it, it's going to turn the entire world into a desert. Now, mankind has not wanted to follow land Sabbaths and Jubilees. We have not wanted to follow any form of sound ecological balance in nature. God instructed us many years ago. He said, back at the Garden of Eden, dress and keep the garden. Dress it and keep it. We haven't dressed it, we have exploited it. We haven't kept it, we have lost it. Hang on, we'll be back with more on Heifer International and Troubled Waters when we return. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour. I'm your host, George Gordon. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, sponsored by the Gordon Law School, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived for your listening convenience on the internet at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. You know, when the federal government came in with the federal income tax back in 1913, the tax was levied only on the super wealthy, the richest one-half of 1% of the population, with a top tax rate of only 7%. Now today, of course, the fears of the early opponents of the tax have been more than fully realized, and by the end of Herbert Hoover's term, the top rate had dropped to 60%, and by the time Franklin D. Roosevelt was done, the top rate was over 90%, and the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class. In 1913, the average family had to work until January 30th to earn enough to satisfy the tax man. This year, the average American family will work all the way through May the 12th in order to earn enough to pay their federal tax, state tax, and local tax bills. May 12th. Tuck that one away. It's called Tax Freedom Day. Now, this income tax and Social Security tax violate 3 of the 10 commandments and 8 statutes of the Old Covenant, including our English common law. And the income tax and Social Security tax are 2 criminal activities. That's why I contend that you owe it to yourself to at least ask the question, do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? For more information about tax and status, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and status is available on compact disc for home education. If you're online, you can go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email, send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Or you can call direct. 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about Heifer International, a quarterly publication. Let me give you the name and address of it. I think it's worth subscribing to. I don't know what the subscription price is. I get a lot of these magazines. And let me flip over here and tell you where to go. Call 800-422-0474. They're located in Little Rock, Arkansas. The Heifer Project International is located at 1015 Louisiana Street, Little Rock, Arkansas, 72202. Again, that's Heifer Project International. Or just write Heifer International. That's spelled H-E-I-F-E-R. 1015 Louisiana Street, Little Rock, Arkansas, 72202. Or you can call direct 1-800-422-0474. That's 1-800-422-0474. And I'm looking at the fall 2003 Troubled Waters. It's called World Ark. That's the name of the magazine, World Ark. Give them a little credit where credit's due. They've got a number of nifty articles. This fall issue is aimed at water and water quality and water quantity, or the water problem around the world. More importantly, what are we going to do about it? What's the solution to the water problem? Are we going to wait for the socialists and the communists to deliver water to us, or should we rely upon ourselves? We'll talk about self-reliance and water self-sufficiency, even in places like Tucson, Arizona, or in the outback of Australia, without any government subsidies whatsoever. We'll talk about that as we progress. Well, most modern irrigation technologies, such as diesel pumps, are too expensive for poor farmers, and increasing the availability and use of affordable small plot irrigation could greatly increase land productivity, incomes, and household food security of the world's poorest farm families. These affordable technologies include human-powered pumps to give access to shallow underground groundwater drip irrigation packages designed specifically for farmers on small plots and inexpensive micro-sprinklers. Now, double water productivity, you know, projected rates of population and economic growth during the next few decades, along with the deterioration of many freshwater ecosystems, means people will have to do more with less water. Humans now use more than half of the accessible renewable freshwater runoff, even if per capita use remained constant. And that figure could rise to 70% by the year 2025, and this would lead to even greater damage to the world's ecosystem. You know, in order to provide access to irrigation water to reduce rural poverty, its access to a minimum amount of water for the production of crops is essential to helping millions of people escape poverty. Remember, about 2.8 billion people live on less than $2 a day, and 800 million of these face chronic hunger every day. Providing poor farmers with the means to irrigate their farms is one of the best ways to help them move out of poverty. Wait a second. Hang on a second. God promised that He would give us rain in due season. Did it ever occur to us that perhaps we're in violation of some basic laws, which causes drought in the West, or the disparaging amounts of rainfall that we see unevenly spread across the world? I know, it sounds a little wild and off the wall, but technologies have now been developed where we don't have to rely upon irrigation. Or if you want to rely upon irrigation, you can irrigate out of the ponds from the drainage that comes off of the roof of your house. Did you know, for instance, if you live in Tucson, Arizona, where it only rains 7 to 10 inches a year, that there is enough rain on 7 to 10 inches a year on your lot, 50 by 100 feet, to provide all of the water that your family uses in a year? Did you know that? And that we used to have water systems called cisterns. It's called the cistern system. To collect that water during periods of rain, and then conserve that water in a cistern, and then use that water during the dry periods. We don't do that anymore, at least not here in America. They still do it in Australia, now back, and many other locations in the Middle East. But you know, even where it only rains 7 to 10 inches a year, there's enough rain there for all the people who live on that piece of real estate. Surprising as it may sound. We Americans have become dependent upon easy, cheap water, like the Colorado River. And you people in Los Angeles are sitting there turning on your water faucet or irrigating your lawns, and you expect that water to be delivered to you 1,000 miles away to be delivered to your faucet. And you want it there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so do all the people in San Diego and all the people in San Francisco and Sacramento, and indeed every little city, hamlet, and town expects the same service. Now, it rains on the ground, we have floods, and the water runs off the ground. It causes great damage, and all the water is lost. We don't care about salvaging or saving that water, storing that water. We want to rely upon the Colorado River. Well, the Colorado River is empty. We have to come up with other solutions. And there are other solutions available. You know, people have been living in desert areas for a long time. I was just out in the West, in Reno, Nevada, and I had an opportunity to visit a couple of ranches out there. A couple of big ranches, 500,000 acres and 750,000 acres. That's a 500,000 and 750,000 acres. That's a big piece of real estate. And it's dry out there in Nevada. In fact, when you're driving across Nevada on Highway 50, you look around and you say, my God, even the rattlesnakes are packing their water bags out here. I was amazed at how much water is out there in that desert. When those ranchers took me up to the springs and the creeks that run out of the mountains and then they run down into the desert and soak into the ground, what those ranchers do is they dig a pipeline, they dig a ditch, and they run that water to where they want it. And then they water cattle out in the middle of the desert. There are wells and water troughs and water ponds out there all over that desert. You don't see them driving down the highway, but they're there. They can drive you out to them. In other words, water management and water conservation is the watchword in the desert. People that live in the desert have to mind all of the water that's available, and they take care of it, and they utilize it, and they use it to great advantage. The people that are the wastrels are the ones that live next to the rivers, the ones where all the water is located. If there's water under your feet, why not pump it out of the ground? Now, the problem with pumping all this water out of the ground is that the water that's underground is in an aquifer. And that aquifer recharges based upon the amount of rainfall. Now, let's suppose that you're living in North Texas, up in the Panhandle. Pretty dry up there, isn't it? Now, it rains up there 20 inches a year, or thereabouts. If you could collect that 20 inches a year, you people would have all the water that you need. There's no shortage of water there in the Panhandle. But instead, they went down and they said, well, what we're going to do is we're going to tap this aquifer. I think they call that the Ogla Aquifer. It stretches from North Dakota down to Texas. And they did, and they pumped it dry, growing cotton. Now, that ground out there, instead of growing cotton, would have probably produced grass like it does up in the desert country in Nevada. You probably could graze cattle out there, but they decided, now we're not going to do that. We're going to grow cotton. Here where I'm at, we're in a forested area. This is a temperate rainforest. It has 50 inches of rain a year, some places more. Well, when you get to 60 inches, you have what's called a rainforest. When you get to 90 inches, you have what's called tropical rainforest. When you're at 40 to 60 inches, it's called a temperate rainforest. When you get down below 40 inches, then it's plains, I guess. And then pretty soon you get down to semi-arid, and then it gets down to arid. They've got classifications for this, where the rain, you know, with the various amounts of rainfall. So in my area here, where we have a temperate rainforest, in order to get the most dollars out of it possible, they take bulldozers out here and bulldoze the trees down, plant grass, and raise cows. Don't you think it would make more sense to raise those cows down in North Texas, where there's low rainfall, and leave these trees here to grow for timber so that we could build houses? We don't do that. I'm just suggesting that wouldn't that make more sense? Couldn't we do more to dress and keep the garden by using the land for its highest and best usage or purpose instead of trying to gain short-term dollar advantage by bulldozing these trees down? Because every time we knock one of these trees down, we shut down 5 gallons a day of rainfall. And every time we shut down the rainfall, we put in desertification. Now, desertification is where we convert the land into desert. Now, desertification is beginning to set in some places in Iowa. Desertification is where the land loses its organic material, and then when the wind blows, when it's dry, the wind blows and blows the sand particles around. We had that out here in the Great Plains. We called it the Dust Bowl. We went out there and plowed that whole thing up, planted wheat, made some money, depleted the land of its organic material, and it blew away in the next drought. So my common sense says to me that we could do a lot better if we want to practice socialism and communism in having our government regulate and control the usage of the land. I mean, after all, that seems to be what people want. Or is it because the people who are on the land are unable to make a determination as to how to dress and keep it? Maybe our schools and our agricultural colleges could do us a bigger, better job if they would teach us how to dress and keep the garden rather than how to use industrial equipment like John Deere choppers and feed wagons and industrial feedlots to rape it, rob it, and pillage it. I know this is a wild new concept for a lot of you, but I just thought that since we're going to practice communism and socialism anyway, that maybe we ought to use communism and socialism and state planning to its highest and best use. Now, if we don't want to practice communism and socialism here on our farm, we actually practice ecological management on our land. We have water here. We don't cut down live trees here. A live tree here is a valuable asset. And the water that it gives off at the rate of 5 gallons a day goes into the atmosphere. It may not rain on my ground, but it will rain on yours. And wouldn't you rather that I left my tree on my land so that you could get 5 gallons of rain on your land? You know, that's what this thing is all about, isn't it? Now, if you leave your tree, and I leave my tree, and instead of cutting down the trees, we plant more trees, or when you cut down a tree. Now, out here in my forest, I've got 240 acres of forest land here, and I manage my forest just like I do a crop. And all of those trees out there have a value. Their first value is the precipitation that they give off, which keeps all the rest of the trees growing and keeps my fields and my grass green and my cows fed and my springs bubbling water out to water my cattle. You know, when we arrived here on the North American continent, we arrived in the Garden of Eden. Somewhere along the line, we dropped the ball. Didn't we? Now we've industrialized and commercialized and we've paved over until we have now created this industrial complex. Take a look at the Los Angeles basin and what we've done there. And then ask yourself, is this really what we wanted? Is this really the way people want to live? They live in these concrete jungles, and then they try to save their money, and when they retire, they want to retire along the beachfront someplace. They want to retire out in the country. Instead of retiring to the country, why don't you live in the country? Why don't you take advantage of the country, which is the natural place for people to live? And people will say to me, well, you can't make any money there. Why do you want to make money? Well, I need to make money so that I can go out and buy a place in the country. Oh, I see. So we live 40 years of our lives suffering in misery in the city to earn enough money to come out in the country and buy a place so that we can retire for the last 10 or 15 years of our life. Why don't we live the whole 55, 60, or 70 years out here in the country where we were designed to live in the first place? I know that sounds like a wild new concept, but some years back I took a look at that and said, you know, I think I can make a living out here on the land. But in order for me to do that, I've got to learn how to use the land. Now, there are 15 agricultural laws that we see in the scripture. 15 agricultural laws that dress and keep the garden, keep it productive forever. I practice those here on our farm. Works like a shot. I'm not short of water. I'm not suffering from a drought. Well, that doesn't mean the drought isn't going to come because, you know, if all of you neighbors around me over here cut your trees down, then I won't have the rain that comes from your trees, will I? So dressing and keeping the garden, then, I think is a better form of education than the agricultural schools that tell us how to make genetically modified seeds so that we can get more out of the ground and rape it, rob it, and pillage it faster than we've been raping it, robbing it, and pillaging it in the past. Well, there's more to the story. You know, close to a doubling of water productivity worldwide, more in some regions and less in others, will be necessary to meet the food and water needs of the global population while projecting ecological integrity. Did you get that? We're going to have to double the amount of available water. It's going to be necessary to feed and water the global population over the next 25 years. We're going to have to double it. You see, the population doubled between, in fact, it tripled between about 1940 and 2000. And that 60 years, it moved from 2.5 billion to 6 billion people. It nearly tripled in 60 years. And they figure over the next 25 or 30 years, it's going to double again. Now, you got 6 billion people in the world. Now, at some point in time, this is going to come to an end. Let me show you what's going on here. You've got a world today that's pretty crowded with 6 billion people in it. And that population doubles about every 25 years. Grows at about 3.5% a year, compounded for 25 years. And so it doubles. You know, every so many years, the population doubles. So the next doubling is going to be from 6 times 2 is 12. Now, if you think 6 billion people are posing a problem today, you're going to have twice that problem 30 years from now. Now, this is the year 2004. You know, 30 years from now, you're going to have in the year 2034, you know, and it's just like 1904, and then there was 1934. 30 years goes by, you know, it goes by pretty fast. I can look back 30 years, didn't seem like 1974, just the other day. You know, when you get to be 65, you can look back 35 years, it's no big deal. Oh yeah, I remember. Yeah, 1974 was a good year. It's when I sold the house in Boise, Idaho, up on Denton Street. I remember remodeling that house. I remember selling it. I remember the guy that bought it. 30 years. Well, 30 years from now, there's going to be 12 billion. Now, in the year 2064, there's going to be 24 billion. Now, unless something unforeseen and pretty dramatic and drastic occurs, you know, like the reduction of the Earth's population by 90% by the Global 2000 folks, and they've got a plan in mind that they intend to put into practice. Well, tuck that one away in your heart and then ask yourself, hey, listen, do you think maybe there's something that you need to do personally, no matter where you live, to provide for yourself a safe, clean water supply, whether you're living in the Los Angeles basin or you're living on the plains of North Dakota? We'll talk more about that as we progress along. I just want to give you the parameters of it, and then I'm going to tell you what the solution is. I've solved my water problem, and I can tell you how to solve your water problem. I don't care whether you live in Tucson, Arizona, or you're living in the Amazon rainforest. Well, increasing the efficiency of irrigation would help. Drip irrigation has been shown to double or triple crop yield per unit of water, but it accounts for only 1% of global irrigated area. Greater recycling of water is another way to increase water productivity. And then number five, they point out that achieving good governance over water. Oh, we need a better socialist government to help us govern this water, don't we? Adopting the public trust as the guiding principle for water management puts a premium on equity and sharing among people, you know, from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. Between people and nature and among countries that share rivers and other bodies of water. Implementing the measures above would take enormous political and social will. It would revolutionize water use and management. It's collectivism and socialism to the nth degree. Refusing or neglecting to take steps to protect the world's supply of fresh water, however, poses far greater risk than trying to reform water policies. Only fundamental change will solve the world's growing water problems, and these changes require that scientists, engineers, conservationists, policymakers, and citizens work together. They require leadership from many quarters, and they require action now, because it may turn out that time to reverse the threatening trends underway is even more limited than water itself. Yeah, I'd go along with that. There's a limited supply of water, and the population of the world is going to grow, whether we like it or not. It's going to grow, and it's going to double over the next 30 years. Now, I may not be here 30 years from now. See, I'm 65 now. 30 years from now, I'd be 95 years old. Well, that's not out of the question. So if I'm here 30 years from now, I'm still going to need water. I need to solve my water problem over the next 30 years. I don't care if I was living in Tucson, Arizona, or if I was living in the Sahara Desert, I've got a water problem, and I've got to solve it for myself. Now, do you believe that the communists and the socialists have got a solution to the water problem? Do you believe that the United States can solve its water problem? Do you believe that the Middle Eastern nations like Saudi Arabia, when their population doubles, they can solve their water problem? How about Iraq? You see, every country in the world's got the same problem, and who's going to solve it? Is it going to be solved by individuals at the local level? And if they are going to solve the problem at the local level, who's going to teach them how to do that, and what is it that they propose to teach them to solve that water problem? Well, believe it or not, in the Bible, there are problems, causes of problems, and solutions to problems, and water is just one of many problems that has a logical, systematic solution through law. 15 agricultural laws, and if we practice those laws, you can solve your water problem. Well, we're just about out of time. I'm going to have to break it off right here. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same station, and we'll be talking about this thing of water. And we'll analyze water from the perspective of the Bible, of all books, and see whether or not there's a logical, systematic solution. And then there's technology that comes into play. Did you know that people have been living in deserts for thousands of years and solved their water problems and grew their food, and they didn't have any irrigation whatsoever? Well, we'll break off right there. You know, you're listening to The Law Hour. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour has been brought to you by the Gordon Law School as an educational service in the public interest. Now, for more information about The Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest by the Gordon Law School. All right, we'll break off right there. Thanks for listening. It's been good being with you, and until next time, goodbye, friends.